thank you for joining us today. I'm Scott Schiff with the Atlas Society with Senior Fellow Rob Trzynski, and JAG, our CEO, is here. Thank you for joining us, Rob. I'd like to ask everyone to share the room, and please raise your hand if you want to join the conversation. We're going to be discussing pathological altruism and the age of trauma. Rob, thanks for doing this topic. What is pathological altruism, and when did the age of trauma start?
Okay, all good questions. All right, so, excuse me. I actually planned this out, this topic, because I'd seen something recently, a news item recently, that suggested it to me. And I did that before knowing that JAG was going to be interviewing Barbara Oakley. Now, Barbara Oakley is, among other things, she was one of the people who developed, who helped bring attention to and popularize the concept of pathological altruism. So there's an interview on the Atlas Society site right now with Barbara Oakley. You can check that out. I haven't had time to listen to the whole thing. I've just done a little bit of it. I'm going to get to it soon because it's a topic I really like, and it's a really interesting, I think, addition, you know, to our understanding of how the culture works and what goes wrong with various things in our culture. All right, so I'll briefly sketch out what pathological altruism is, but I want to make a point that for those who are familiar with objectivism and with Ayn Rand's arguments, Ayn Rand, the pathological altruism in Ayn Rand's philosophy is a redundancy. All altruism is pathological. And what Ayn Rand argued and what she pointed out is, by the very nature of saying to people, you shouldn't pursue your own happiness, you should pursue the happiness of others, altruism creates immense problems. And the great example of that in her literature, in her fiction, the one that jumps out at me most is an example, a good example of what you would call pathological altruism or the pathologies of altruism, is in The Fountainhead, she has the character of Peter Keating, who's sort of this ultimate conformist, the guy who, you know, goes out and tries to find out what's popular, what do people want him to be, and then he goes out and to become that, you know, to do whatever's popular, to do whatever people, to become whatever people want him to become. But he learned that at home. He learned that at home from his mother. So the relationship here is the relationship between Peter Keating and his mother, Louisa Keating. And the way the relationship works, and it's, see if this sounds familiar at all, because there's a lot of this that happens out in the world, which is that she is constantly sacrificing her happiness for the sake of her son, trying to get him in a better position in the world, trying to help him rise up and become more successful. And of course, she's constantly reminding him of how much she's sacrificing for him. Well, we would, in my era, we called this a guilt trip. So she's constantly giving him a guilt trip about how much she sacrificed for him to help make him successful and pursue this brilliant career. But here's the thing, he doesn't want the career. She's, you know, she's pushed him to become an architect. He doesn't want to be an architect. He's only doing it because he feels guilty, so he's doing it to make her happy. So the way this sort of toxic relationship works between these two people is she's sacrificing her happiness for his sake in order to make him happy, while he's sacrificing his happiness for her sake in order to make her happy. And the actual result is they're both sacrificing and nobody's happy. Everybody's miserable. All right, so this is how Ayn Rand, one of the ways in which Ayn Rand, sort of diagnose the pathology of altruism as a moral philosophy, as an approach to life. The pathology is that by giving up on your own happiness as a goal and making your primary goal the happiness of someone else, who is in turn also expected to give up his own happiness to sacrifice for somebody else, you basically create a system in which everybody sacrifices and nobody enjoys anything. And this is, you know, she works this out thoroughly in The Fountainhead. She takes to new directions and deeper analysis in Atlas Shrugged. Now, this is something that's considered, though, radically wrong and radically different from the standard view people have, where selfishness is viewed as synonymous with evil And self-sacrifice or altruism is viewed as synonymous with morality, with decency, with virtue. All right. So the closest that people have gotten in the mainstream to identifying the pathologies of altruism is in the coinage of this, the closest that I've seen is in the coinage of this term, pathological altruism. Now, when Barbara Oakley used it, she used it in a narrower sense, and I'm curious to see Jag's interview to see how far she's willing to take it. But she used it in a more narrow sense that, well, altruism is okay. Wanting to help other people is okay. There are good versions of that, but it can go wrong, and therefore there are bad versions. And the bad versions are the sorts of things that have actually become sort of familiar to us in psychology, like in pop psychology. The idea of a codependent relationship or an enabler. So one of the examples of pathological altruism would be if someone you love is a drug addict, is addicted to drugs. And so, and you notice, and they're out of money, they're down and out, they're down on their luck, and you give them money to help them out. Now, are you really helping them? Well, what are they going to do if somebody's a drug addict and you give him money? What's he going to do? Well, he's going to go out and he's going to buy drugs, and he's going to become even more addicted. You know, the behavior that's destroying his life is you're going to enable that to continue. And there are, you know, the concept of a codependent relationship, as I understand it, is that the person who does the enabling, who does the helping for the person who's dependent on drugs or alcohol, that person is themselves dependent on, they're codependent on the alcohol. They're dependent on the sense of virtue they get from being the person who helps out, who comes to the rescue all the time. All right, so we understand, you know, there's some understanding that's seeped into the culture of how this idea of supposedly having good intentions but wanting to help somebody else can become toxic. It can become toxic to both people. That you are, you know, it becomes that Peter Keating, Louisa Keating relationship where you're both sacrificing for the other and everybody's sacrificing and nobody's actually benefiting. Now, Ayn Rand's case was that all altruism is pathological by the nature of altruism, by the nature of saying that it's bad to pursue your own interests, it's bad to pursue your own enjoyment, and everybody should sacrifice for somebody else. You are inherently creating that situation across the world. This is the villain of the Fountainhead says, across the globe, Peter, this is how it's going to be. Everyone's sacrificing for the sake of the person next to him, who's sacrificing for the sake of the person next to him, and all will suffer and none will enjoy. And that's the actual result of altruism as a moral philosophy. All right, so I found pathological altruism to be a great formulation of this, and like I said, the closest people have gotten, they're still not going all the way, but the closest people have gotten to understanding the pathologies of altruism as, you know, the comprehensively pathological nature of altruism as Ayn Rand identified it. And if you say, oh, well, you know, what does altruism really mean? Let's put that into the discussion. I think that'd be a good question to bring up. But what I wanted to talk about was the main way we see that, particularly in our current era. And it's an article, a good article that came out in the New York Times. And, you know, that doesn't always happen. So we should, you know, take a moment to acknowledge this. A good article that came out in the New York Times. This is February 4th by Jessica Bennett, who's written some interesting things recently, actually. And the title is If Everything is Trauma, Is Anything? And it's about the overuse of the word trauma. You probably see this. People talk about their emotional trauma. One of their examples is she leads out with an example of some sort of social media phenomenon a year or so ago, of some guy who was, you know, like this, you know, serial dater who would, you know, date girls, go out with them for a while and then ghost them and dump them and go on to somebody new. Right. And back in the old days, we just said, oh, the guy's a cad. You know, it's not exactly a new personality type, but there was some woman writing about this guy that she knew who was like this, and it was all talking about the trauma of it. And she points out, Bennett points out, that trauma, its original meaning, it's from medicine, right? A gunshot wound is trauma, right? It means a major a major wound, a wound that causes major damage to the body. And but by the sort of the pop culture seeping through, trauma has come to mean pretty much anything that discomforts you, anything that any bad thing, bad or uncomfortable or annoying thing that happens to you has suddenly become trauma. And the phrase used here is semantic creep, to describe how the meanings of words change over time. And so this quotes a psychologist named Nick Haslam from the University of Melbourne in Australia, who talks about trauma creep, when the language of the clinical, or at least the clinical adjacent, you know, the psychological, is used to refer to an increasingly expansive sense of everyday experiences, right? So we have lots of things that just happen, everyday annoyances, what we used to call a pet peeve, right? An everyday annoyance of, you know, bad things that just sort of happen within the normal course of life. When those become described as trauma, as serious harm, and where the concept is, as they put it, medicalized here in this article. And apparently there's on TikTok, in one of these social media sites, there's a little sub community called Trauma Talk, where people talk about their trauma and all the different things that you know, that they can find that going on in their life that they are able to characterize as trauma. And it's a great article, talks about this and talks about some of the reasons why this is a problem, which is that if you are convinced that every single little bad thing that happens to you, like, you know, dating a guy who isn't really that interested in you and moves on to somebody else pretty quickly, if every little thing like that becomes trauma, one of the things that's going to happen is how likely are you to bounce back from it and to be able to cope and to be able to move on with your life? Well, you're actually far more likely, if you view it as trauma, you're far more likely to experience it as being traumatic, to experience it as being something that will take you months to get over with. And as somebody put, and that it will actually reduce your resiliency. And this is something that, you know, in criticisms of the sort of the woke trigger warning kind of culture, it's something people have been pointing out, that this is increasing the psychological fragility of people who take this stuff seriously. Because if everything in your life, every little annoyance is a trauma, you're going to be constantly view yourself as an invalid, as a cripple. Well, I probably can't use the word cripple, as differently abled. You're going to view yourself as constantly recovering from some fresh new assault that seems insurmountable. So it's a way of making people more fragile, of taking away their sense of their own resiliency, their ability to deal with the various problems of life. Now, when talking about why this is so popular, one of the things they point out is, here's a quote from the article. "We also know that victims of wrongdoing tend to be perceived as more moral or virtuous than others." And it's not a huge leap then to imagine that deploying the language of trauma or of harm or even of personal struggle carries cultural capital. And there's a, she quotes somebody else saying, "There's an economy in knowing that people will have a highly emotional outsized response. There's clout in it." And somebody else says, where's this quote here? If you say, you know, this, my boyfriend hurt my feelings, nobody really cares. But if you say he's an abuser and this is trauma, then everybody will care. So this is, you know, the reason why this has a certain appeal, the reason why people adopt this language of trauma, despite that sort of infantilizing that infantilizing effect it has on them of reducing their resiliency. And that struck me as being a great example. Now, the connection is not made in this article, but it struck me as being a great example that we can see widespread in the culture right now, this in this particular form, a great example of the pathology of altruism. That if altruism teaches you the best thing you can be is somebody who has sacrificed, somebody who is a victim, it's going to cause people to search out ways to be victims. There will be, as they put it in here, cultural capital in being a victim. It will give you a sense of being virtuous. It'll make everybody care about what's happening with your life. So it will cause people to search out ways to view themselves as victims. But it's an example of how, in doing that, you know, altruism is supposed to be the supposed appeal of altruism is about everybody's going to care about you and everybody's going to help you. But in doing that, what it's actually doing is it is taking away your ability to cope with everyday life, with even the simplest things in everyday life, and causing you to become much more fragile and basically to live in a world of constant harm and constant trauma, where you feel constantly like you are an invalid who's trying to overcome something rather than a person who's trying to go out and accomplish something worthwhile in life. So I think that's it. I wanted to bring that episode of this as I think the preeminent contemporary form of the pathology in which the pathology of altruism is experienced and acted out in the culture at this particular time. And then I think I want to open for discussion this question of, you know, is there a good version of altruism, as Barbara Oakley tends to think? Is there a good version of altruism? Why did Ayn Rand take the position? Why do I take the position that it's altruism as such that is the pathology and not just a sort of a misguided version of it? All right, so let's open for discussion.
Great, thank you. You know, I just wanted to add one personal story that I what you said reminded me of. I had a friend who, she had brain surgery for epilepsy and she got on disability. And the doctor told her that she should maybe go back to work part-time. She was a hairstylist. And it was going back to work that actually got her removed from disability. And I thought it's kind of almost like the policy of trauma that they want you to continue to say that, you know, you're unable to work to keep getting money.
Oh, yeah. Social Security disability, by the way, is one of the major forms of pathological altruism in our society right now. Because the idea is supposed to be, oh, it's for people who have, you know, suffered some sort of injury and they're unable to work. It's going to temporarily help them to support them and help them to get by while they're unable to work. But the open secret about disability is people go on it temporarily and they never come off. That the huge number of people who go on Social Security disability basically never go to work again. They never go back into the workforce. Because you can get a check coming to your a check coming in automatically into your account every month to provide everything to provide a basic, not a very good living, but a basic minimum. You get that coming in, but if you go back to work, you lose it. So it creates that perverse incentive for people to remain helpless and to remain, oh, my back still isn't good enough. I can't go back to work. And now a whole bunch of people, by the way, go on disability and they continue to get work on the side under the table while also getting the check. But, you know, I had some years ago, last time I had before they tore down the house in which he was living, it was in that bad of shape. I had a neighbor who was, it's probably 15, 20 years ago, plotting to get on Social Security disability. Now, what was his disability? His disability was that he was a drunk, right? So, he saw that Social Security disability was the land of opportunity for him because he could, you know, make up some story about, oh, back pains or this or that or anything, and he couldn't work. And they basically, he'd get a check every month and be able to go out and buy liquor. So it's another example of how, you know, in this case, we talked about somebody being codependent with a person who's addicted to drugs or alcohol. In this case, the codependent party is the United States government and the American taxpayer.
Great. Well, I want to recognize TAS founder David Kelly. David, I don't know if you had a question or. Well, if not, we'll go to. I think Roger was originally up here first, and then we'll go to Alan. Roger, how's it going?
Well, I'm glad you guys are doing this room. There's been a lot of talk on this app about altruism, and but I love this tie-in to the age of trauma. And it's funny because I just read an article yesterday talking about the breakup between Pete Davidson from Saturday Night Live and Kim Kardashian. And in this article, it was talking about Pete Davidson is seeking help for the trauma that was caused because of harassment by Kanye West. And I don't want to dismiss that somebody could experience trauma from legitimate harassment, but when I see people that publicize their romance and then receive criticism over it and are now seeking help for the trauma that that created, I think this speaks to the way that we've overused this concept of trauma. And I think the worry around that is that there are some people that legitimately do suffer trauma. And in order to make sure that people get the help that they need, it's important that we don't confuse, the normal trials of life with trauma, whether it's acute or chronic or whatever version of trauma you might be associated with. Not every problem bubbles up to that. And it reminds me of a thing that George Carlin talked about in his stand-up, where he said that, you know, once upon a time, before we referred to soldiers experiencing trauma as having post-traumatic stress syndrome, we used to call it shell shock. And the softening of the language and the overuse of the language almost makes it seem less severe. And I'm just curious to tie this into a question for you, Rob. How do we get back to a world where we could get people the help that they need when they're suffering trauma, and maybe tell people that aren't suffering trauma to suck it up? Like, is there a polite way of doing that?
Well, I think you just said it, suck it up. But no, it's like, okay, Pete Davidson. I have only the vaguest idea who Pete Davidson is. But, you know, okay, he dated a hot chick who has an angry ex-husband. Well, that's not, you know, that's ordinary life. That is not trauma. But what you're talking about, people who have legitimately suffered, I think one advance we've made in the last few decades is the recognition of PTSD, or what used to be called shell shock, was now PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. The recognition of that as a real thing, because it used to be, oh, you know, suck it up, that's war is hell, you should just go on with your life. Realizing that this is something that is a real psychological problem, and that there are ways to treat it, and there are ways to at least recognize it. And, you know, I think that's something as a positive thing that has been developed for people who went through war, right? For people who were shot at, for people who were being bombed or shelled or what have you. But obviously, you know, that shows the differentiation is that, you know, having a girlfriend with an angry ex is not the same thing as getting shot at repeatedly over a period of months on the front lines of a battlefield. So I do absolutely think, you know, that the terminology of trauma and some of these concepts like post-traumatic stress disorder developed in psychology, often for very good reasons, to help identify cases in which people really do have trouble and need help and need treatment. And there are ways to, and you know, there's been some discussion about how to do this, but I think they've come up with some relatively effective ways for treating this if you recognize it and understand what's going on. But it was created for a legitimate reason, but because of pathological altruism, everybody jumps on the bandwagon. Oh, there's a new form of there's a new form of victimhood in town. Let's everybody sign up because it doesn't, you know, because it makes you one of the good guys. It makes you special. It gives you something to it gives you something to bring attention and value to yourself. And so Pete Davidson can get a couple more social media cycles out of the fact that Kanye West was mean to him. All right. So I think as to how you end it, well, first of all, you might, I don't think there's necessarily a polite way. You know, for some of these people, I'm not inclined to find a polite way. For other people, I am inclined to find a more polite way. But I think on a culture-wide level, I think it just shows that we have to reconsider the concept of altruism and try to identify what it really means and root out that altruist premise. Because that's the thing that activates people. That's the thing that activates people, that when they see some new form of trauma or victimhood or some new pathology that's identified by the psychologist or psychiatrist, they all flock to it and say, oh, that's me too, because I need to be victimized. I need to be suffering, because under altruism, suffering is something that adds value and meaning to my life. And that, I think, is what so it's questioning that underlying, what does altruism mean, identifying the pathology of it that I think is necessary ultimately to sort of end this cycle as much as it can be ended.
Great. Thank you for that. I believe, David, you wanted to get in here?
Yeah, I did. Thank you. First of all, I think, you know, Roger's point is excellent. There's a psychological and cultural parallel to the old saw in economics, that bad money drives out good. When a concept gets inflated like trauma, it drives out, you know, it diminishes the real meaning of it. And, you know, that hurts the people, who, as Rob was saying, who actually have experienced like battlefield trauma. What I wanted to say, though, is I was wondering what the connection Rob was going to draw between pathological egoism, altruism, sorry about that, and victimhood. And I think I see now. I think there are two senses of altruism, or two themes or strains of altruism. One is that you should sacrifice to others. That's a form of altruism, often confused with benevolence. And that's what Peter Keating's mother kept insisting she was doing. But there's also this strain of altruism that the notion that that it will be there's an article I wrote some years back on this subject. Anyway, the other strain is that the inversion of values that Ayn Rand described in Galt's speech that is reflected in the Beatitudes, blessed are the poor, not the rich, the poor, because they will inherit evil. I'm sorry, they will inherit the
earth.
They will inherit the earth. Blessed are they that mourn, for they shall be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. So it's not the successful. It's altruism in this sense elevates the unsuccessful, the poor, the meek, the poor in spirit, the including, you know, moral stature. And I think that's a strain of altruism that is connected with, at least I'll put it as a question to Rob. It seems to me that's a connection that a form of altruism that's connected with victimhood. That you make yourself a victim, that's how you get cultural capital, because it says you're powerless, impotent, so help me, help me, help me. And those who don't are guilty.
Yeah, I agree with that, and that's part of Ayn Rand's analysis of it. But I think that it's the connection between those two, that when you create that moral system, you are creating that hierarchy of values, where, you know, the lack of value, the weakness, the poverty, is not just economic poverty, but spiritual poverty, becomes the thing that puts meaning and value into your life. I've mentioned before, there's a study done, I never remember the guys' names, but there's two guys who did a study about 10 years or so ago, where they had this whole discussion about how different societies are based on different basic principles about what gives meaning and value to your life, what gives meaning, value, and direction to your life. And they said, you know, long time ago, centuries ago, it was the culture of honor. And, honor was not just that you had a certain position or reputation, but it was specifically that reputation in the eyes of others. So you had to be treated a certain way and have a certain position and status in society in order to maintain your honor. And if your honor was challenged, you had to, you know, you had to duel somebody or fight somebody to regain that honor. And then that was followed, they said, by a culture of dignity, whereas your own personal internal sense of your self-worth. So even like somebody like Frederick Douglass, who was a slave, could still have dignity. It's something you couldn't, nobody can take from you because it's your own internal assessment of your self-worth. And then they said what happened is that got in the 20th century, that got replaced with a culture of victimhood, where victimhood is what gives meaning and value and organization to your life. And it's what gives you, confers status on you. And so everybody has to then find ways to be a victim, right? And that's where this trauma comes in. But then as far as the connection to altruism, I think it's interesting that altruism is a word that has gone through a kind of modification from its origins. I think there are three sort of steps to it. So originally, the term altruism, you know, this is not an ancient term. This is a relatively recent term coined in the 19th century by a guy named Auguste Comte as part of this sort of religion of humanity that he created that was supposed to be a secular replacement for traditional religion. And in that, he created this moral, the idea of a moral code called altruism, and it comes from the Latin word meaning other. So it's otherism, and it's the idea that sacrificing for the sake of others is the only purpose of your life. It's the only moral purpose of your life. You can only do something for yourself only insofar as that's a the bare minimum necessary, basically, to keep body and soul together, so that you can go on serving others. And of course, the contradiction there is if the one brought up by Tui and other people, which is if you are sacrificing everything in order to serve others, and those other people are expected to also live by this altruist philosophy and sacrifice everything to serve others, everybody's sacrificing and nobody's profiting. But you know, he pushed this as his sort of secular religion, pushed this idea of altruism as a totalizing sort of code of living in which you do nothing but act for the sake of others. And everything you do is justified by reference to how is this helping other people. Now, what happens is altruism, this idea that emerges in Europe, it comes to America in the late 19th century. And I got a chance to look into that sort of forgotten history on that a little bit. And it was brought in actually more as a social system. There was one guy who wrote a series of stories about Altruria, which is this fictional country that's run totally on altruist principles. And he has this Altrurian traveler who's coming to America and always explaining how things in America are so much worse than they are back in Altruria, where everything's run according to this ideal system, right? And it's sort of a preview in the 1890s-ish, as I recall, a preview a few decades earlier of the later person who would come back and say, oh, everything's better in the Soviet Union, and we have the ideal perfect society in the Soviet Union. But this is the fictional Altruria that they did it from. And what happened to Altruria, or to altruism as a movement in the U.S. when it hit here, and from the research I've seen, what happened to it is it dissipated as a social movement, because it got absorbed by the existing cultural forces in the country. So some of the people who were into altruism in this in Auguste Comte's sense, this sort of total system of sacrifice for others, some people who were into it drifted into Marxism and into, you know, the sort of mainstream of the left, because it gave them a whole economic explanation and an economic system. So they became Marxists. They went to the Marxist left. And then the other group of people who were affected by altruism, it was absorbed by traditional religion, because, you know, what does traditional Christianity say? The goal, the ideal person, the ideal way to act in life is Christ on the cross, sacrificing himself by allowing himself to be tortured to death for the sake of others. So the traditional religious types grabbed onto altruism. And so as a distinct movement, it kind of dissipated, but it got co-opted by the existing social movements that were very compatible with it, that were advocating one form or another, either a religious form of altruism or a secular economic form of altruism. All right, so then what happens is that having lost its meaning as a specific movement, altruism then became watered down to now where it's just kind of used in this very superficial and imprecise form. And this is actually how, and the stuff I read from Barbara Oakley, this is how she used it. It's mean anything intended to help another person. Well, you see the problem with that, which is if you do, if it's anything that's intended to help another person, it includes this, you know, a much broader swath of everyday actions. It doesn't include this idea of the belief that pursuing anything that's good for you is evil. It doesn't include that sort of culture of that lack of value, and that being a victim, that being suffering gives your life meaning and value. So it's a way in which altruism as a word has sort of lost its original meaning and become this very superficial thing. But the thing is, if you use it in that way of meaning anything intended to help another person, then you can see that you have that sort of August Comte version, the pathological version of altruism, which is very opposed to the requirements of human life, gets lumped in with any single act of benevolence that you might happen to do for another person, right? So if you see an old friend and you say, hey, let me buy you a cup of coffee, you know, that suddenly becomes altruism, equivalent to, you know, the Peter and Louisa Keating, you know, Peter Keating and his mom. These are two very, very different things that are going on. One's kindness, benevolence, goodwill towards a friend, and the other is this sort of death spiral of self-sacrifice that these two people are involved in. So that's why I think that, you know, sort of reminding people of the original meaning of this concept and cleaning up the language in that way, I think it is extremely, it is like a huge necessary task, because if people aren't making differentiations between simple benevolence and this creed of that in which self-sacrifice is the essence of morality, then they're not going to be able to understand what's really going on. And they're going to be, you know, that fuzzy dividing line, put it this way, it'll make a future Peter Keating a lot more likely to sort of be able to be taken in by this sort of guilt trip of, oh, I've sacrificed so much for you, Peter, that, you know, he will think of that as benevolence, as goodwill, and not recognize it as the deadly trap that it actually is.
So, Rob, just to wrap up, I couldn't agree more about the need to distinguish altruism from benevolence. But I still think that what you're talking about, the victimhood, the elevation of victimhood as a virtue signal, is tied in with the other aspect of the inversion of values that Glenn talked about, that the blessed are the poor, et cetera. It's the lack of that, it's the lack of value that gives you, you know, social value, which is, I think, a big factor in fueling envy and derivatively egalitarianism.
And also, I want to say that, you know, the phenomenon you're talking about, that sort of cultural inversion of values, that's also tied into things that are not directly related to morality, but are even like beneath the love, you know, more fundamental than the moral questions. You know, one example I see of that is it's become sort of it was always a thing, but it's become even more of a thing in the last few years, in the sort of partly because of the Trump era, is this sort of crowing about this sort of reverse snobbery of, because I'm a simple person from the country who's uneducated, basically. And, you know, I'm not one of the elites. I'm a simple, uneducated person from the country who doesn't know all these things. That makes me better. It makes me superior. There's that sort of anti-intellectualism that has become very popular. We're in a populist era, right, where the everyone needs to at least claim to be one of the common man. We get a lot of dubious claims there. Dr. Oz is running for Senate in Pennsylvania, and did an ad where he is trying to sympathize with the common man about high prices at the grocery store. And this is obviously a guy who has not shopped in the grocery store for his own food in decades. And he goes on, you know, talking about sympathizing with the masses about the expensive price of vegetables for a crudité platter. And it's like a parody of, you know, the multimillionaire with probably an army of servants to wait on him hand and foot, trying to pretend to sympathize with the common man. But it's because we're in this populist era where basically being undistinguished and coming from nowhere and, you know, not having gone to school and being essentially, you know, that your lack of value in that sense becomes part of what gives you value. And it comes partly from altruism, but it also comes from, because I think victimhood culture has sort of made us trying to worm its way into the conservative movement. We used to make fun of it. The right people on the right used to make fun of it. Now they're saying, oh, I'm the greatest victim. But it also comes from the anti-intellectualism, and I think it comes from religious roots, that there are a lot of conservatives, religious traditionalists, who like this idea of basically denigrating advanced, sophisticated knowledge, especially scientific knowledge, and advanced education, and saying, no, basically the ignorance of the simple common man is superior. And the reason they're doing that is not because of altruism or morality. It's because they have a sort of a metaphysical and epistemological axe to grind. They want to deny reason to make room for faith. And so, you know, this idea of denigrating knowledge and sophistication in favor of the virtues of the common man comes not just from a moral goal that they have, but from the goal of trying to sort of prop up and rescue religion and give an elevated status to religion. So there's other, you know, I think that's what you're getting at, is that there are wider issues involved that are fueling this inversion of values.
Thank you for that.
Thanks, Rob. I agree. Back to you, Scott.
I think just a quick counterpoint before we go to Alan. I just think it is possible that some people are reacting to a sense that there's corruption in some of the institutions more than just an anti-intellectual attitude.
Oh, but Scott, there can't possibly be corruption in the institutions. Yeah, no, absolutely, you are correct. Populism always has this sort of double aspect to it, right? That is populism as a mass movement. There's always people who are populist for reasons you like and people who are populist for reasons you don't like. It tends to get mixed up.
That's fair. Alan, thank you so much for your patience.
Yeah, thanks, Scott. I'm going to try and comment, but it's going to be difficult having just learned that Pete Davidson broke up with Kim Kardashian. I don't know if I can recover from the emotional trauma of that, but I'll soldier on. You know, this the whole link between altruism and victimhood, it all reminds me, if you're familiar with the personality typing system called the Enneagram, maybe you've heard of it, but within it, there are 9 personality types, and one of them is called the helper. And the idea, and not only with that, but with all the other types, that the helper ties his self-worth in with his ability to help other people. So he feels he's a good person because he's able to help other people and be benevolent and be altruistic. But it also discusses levels of integration and disintegration. So at the highest level, an altruistic person will help others, but that helping is not tied in with his self-esteem, as opposed to at the bottom level, that person is helping someone but expecting something in return and grows bitter and angry if they're not shown the quote proper levels of gratitude for what they did. And at the heart of it is, and this is an indictment of most of altruism as it occurs in the political stage, is that if you really ask the helper or the altruistic person if they actually care about the people they're helping, their answer will be no, that they don't care about it. So I just offer that is, you know, this is an extremely brief overview of the entire system, but just as an invitation for possible exploration, that it describes perfectly what is going on, both in people who victimize themselves, but also the people, like you've discussed, who promote this idea that the perfect society would be where people are only thinking of others.
Yeah, actually, I'm glad you brought that up, because there are certain, especially certain professions, where thinking of yourself as helping others would be totally normal and healthy and almost unavoidable. Like, you know, if you're a doctor or a nurse, right? And if you do your job well, you could be saving somebody's life or making them, you know, helping them recover from a disease. You are helping them. If you're a firefighter, you know, you do your job well, you save somebody from a fire. So you are helping other people. And I think the difference is that issue of, you know, how is this connected to your self-esteem? What is your expectation for what you get in return? And also for the idea that, you know, if you're helping other people in a mutually beneficial way, where, you know, if you're a doctor, you're saving lives, you're also being paid well for it, right? So it's, you know, you are prospering by using your skills, you are prospering, and at the same time helping somebody else. And that's, I mean, that's not just a description of a doctor. In when you talk about a physician or a nurse, it's in this very obvious way that they're helping other people. But, you know, anybody who's performing a productive job is, you know, you're getting paid, and some customer somewhere who's getting this product or who's the ultimate beneficiary of your actions, that person is also better off. So, but that brings us out of the altruist world, in the Comtean sense of altruism, where, you know, you are sacrificing purely, you know, where pursuit of your own self-interest is evil, and you should purely be oriented towards helping other people. It takes us into the capitalist enlightened self-interest, rational self-interest approach, where I'm benefiting and you're benefiting. We're both, you know, we're engaging in mutually beneficial action for which we both gain value. So it's taking it out of that altruist context and putting it back in that sort of enlightenment, rational self-interest, enlightened self-interest, moral framework. And I think that's why that's the fundamental difference. But also, you know, it is true that in its pathological form, that I'm helping you, therefore you owe me something in return, or therefore it gives me some kind of control, is a major feature of it. One of the more intriguing wrote that I think recommend, it's one that's not well known, unless you're, you know, well versed in her works, but it's it's a play that she wrote fairly early on called Think Twice. It's a murder mystery, and the twist on the murder mystery is that the guy who's murdered is known as a great altruist and humanitarian. And so initially, when the detective comes to investigate, he thinks, well, this is going to be the hardest case in the world, because who could possibly want to kill this guy? And he starts interviewing all the people around him and discovers everybody hates and resents him because his help to all these other people as a humanitarian, his help always comes with strings attached. And each of the people he's drawn into his orbit by helping them, he's done it by taking away some aspect of what they really wanted in life. And they all felt, you know, guilty and felt like they had to put up with it, because after all, he's been so benevolent, he's been so helpful to me. And so the guy ends up saying, I didn't think anybody would want to kill him. Now I've got more suspects than I know what to do with. You know, any one of these people could have had a motive to kill him. And that was her sort of trying to identify that aspect of it, that comes with expectations and strings attached and a sense of control, and stifles the person that is supposedly trying to help. And that's the pathology of that altruist moral mindset.
Good. Thank you for that. We've got three questioners. I don't know if we'll have time, but we'll start with Maximus, see if we can get through them.
Thanks, Scott. Yeah, this is Maximus. So in this discussion, I've been reflecting on some thoughts I've had about victimhood and Marxism, and this term I really like, this pathological altruism. And I'm seeing a kind of distinction here that might be helpful, maybe some references to some ideas. If you haven't read them, you know, any of the attendees might find some interest in them. First, I've made some observation that it seems like humans get into a lot of trouble sometimes with pathological behaviors based on kind of a fundamental human instinct. So this victimhood mentality and this culture of pointing out victimhood and kind of pointing out personal traumas or struggles seems to be related to maybe more to empathy than altruism. In this discussion, I'm reminded of, I think it was a work by Jonathan Haidt, a book he wrote called Righteous Minds, where he talked about like a moral framework for how people make moral decisions. And I can't help but think of this victimhood mentality in this in the culture being related to what he called care foundation as like a moral foundation of humans, kind of universally across cultures, if I remember the book correctly. And the, I guess the, maybe the underlying human tendency or kind of instinctual behavior, or let's say software that humans run on, might be empathy. This idea of if we see someone suffering, it's kind of abnormal to be indifferent to someone else's suffering. It's instinctive to at least empathize with or recognize and to some extent even feel some of the suffering another human goes through. And that's more of the vibe that I get from this victimhood part of the culture right now, is this kind of celebration or elevation or even sanctification of emotional or physical pain. And I remember, I think Jonathan Haidt had talked about this idea that some of these advocates for the sanctification of discomfort or pain, even emotional pain, Haidt talks about this conflation of physical violence with, you know, this emotional violence, or even if someone makes you feel uncomfortable.
Can we just wrap this into a question a little bit?
Yeah,
Oh, that's okay. Yep, that's okay. So that I just wanted to point that out. I wonder if this maybe this might be considered pathological empathy rather than pathological altruism. Though I can see like this Marxism might be pathological altruism.
Yeah. Well, I think empathy is related to this, but I want to talk about that a little bit, because empathy is a natural feeling that you have, that you're for your fellow man. If you see somebody suffer, you think, oh, that's terrible. You feel sorry for them. But here, a couple things about that. One is that you don't necessarily think, therefore, I should upend my entire life in order to serve him. But also, here's the thing that I find interesting about it, which is empathy. When you say empathy, you think, oh, somebody else is suffering and I feel a fellow feeling with them. But why would empathy just mean when somebody else is suffering? Wouldn't it also mean that you enjoy somebody else's achievements with them? Wouldn't, and we all know this feeling, like you're watching your favorite team win the game, right? And you're jumping up and down, pumping your fists. Well, you didn't do anything. You didn't catch the ball. You didn't score a goal. You didn't do anything that that elation doesn't come from what you did, but it comes from your empathy with the elation of the players on the team that they've struggled hard and they won the big game and they got the championship or whatever it was that was on the line. So I think it's the altruist and sort of victimhood worship attitude that causes you, when you think of empathy, to immediately go to, oh, somebody's suffering, right? As if that's the only way to feel a sense of solidarity with your fellow man. And I'm not giving you a hard time for this, because this is so common. This is the way the language has been used and the way the attitudes have been shaped around this victim worship, that empathy immediately means only, I feel bad when somebody else is suffering and I feel bad for them and want to help them. It doesn't mean any of the good things that are involved in empathy or in sympathy with your fellow human being.
That's a good point, a good distinction. It maybe compassion would have been a better word. That's a good point.
No, but I think that, again, like I said, compassion or empathy is natural and normal. It's the excessive focus on things that go bad, and that things that go bad are the real essence of life, and that therefore your goal in life should be to help other people for whom things are going bad, that's the only thing that's really important in the world. I think that's what I'm talking about when I talk about the pathological altruism or the victimhood mentality that we're talking about, where that's become inverted, right? So it takes this natural thing that is actually quite normal and turns it into a bad direction because because of that change in emphasis. All right, do we have time for one more, Scott?
Yeah, Kevin?
Well, I'd like to follow up on what you said. You know, as a counselor, as a school counselor, and having been counseling for a while now, you know, I would venture to say that most counselors that got into it, and you know, during our cohort that we went down on a in which over 1,000 psychiatrists and counselors were there, we discussed this very thing. And most people that are in counseling have actually ventured into pain. They've ventured into it. They've gone through it. And they absolutely are masters of their craft, so to speak. And it is not so much a ego rather than, you know, an expression of, here is a direction. You know, no psychiatrist I've ever heard of are going to tell you they have all the answers. And so you would assume that, you know, this altruism that you're talking about, pathological, I'm a little pushing back against that definition, pathological. You know, I'm of the opinion personally that when we get into absolutes, we're always going to get in trouble, because there are people, you know, in the hearts that I met, people that do what they do because of they want people to avoid the pain. They want them to heal and become better members of society. It's similar to what doctors do.
Kevin, we've got a wrap at the top of the hour, so I just want to give them a chance to answer you.
Okay.
Yeah, we can come up. I think that's a good point that, you know, I think one thing I've observed, and maybe this, I don't know how this corresponds to your experience, but, you know, I know some people who go into psychiatry or to counseling, that sort of thing, because they themselves have experienced, you know, a something traumatic, or I don't say traumatic, undercutting my own clubhouse. They've experienced some sort of psychological pain or distress in their own life, and they figured out how to get through it. And they basically say, I want the next person who experiences this, I want to share with them the things that they can do to recover and make it easier for them. And I think, you know, that's a great motivation to have. But I said, like I said, the difference here is in the, you know, I think a lot of people, when I talk about pathological altruism, again, altruism has come to mean benevolence, wishing for a man, but it also has that connection to it, an underlining meaning of this idea that you have no right to be happy in your own life. Your only function is to sacrifice for the sake of others. And the way that can twist people into very unpleasant and very pathological relationships. And I think that's the thing that like I said, I'm trying to crusade to root out that association of altruism with this sort of superficially good thing, when it also means something that can be very damaging to people. And, you know, what the most damaging thing to a person's life is to be told, you don't really have a right to be happy, right? That's like the worst thing psychologically you could do to someone, because, you know, if they don't think they have a right to be happy, they're not going to do the things that they need to do in order to become psychologically healthy and cope with the problems of life and, you know, get to that benevolent place.
I see where you're coming from now. So thank you for the distinction. And I'll go ahead and park whatever else response I have. There's other folks on the stage. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate that. Unfortunately, we're not going to have time to get to them, but I do want to let everyone know the Atlas Society tomorrow at 5 p.m. Eastern, Rob and David Kelly will be discussing current events. That'll be across all channels. And then Thursday back here on Clubhouse at 4 p.m. Eastern, Richard Salzman's topic will be presumed guilty regulations versus rights. So I'm looking forward to both of those sessions. Rob, thank you so much for doing this. Thanks to everyone who participated. This was a great topic, and we'll see you this week.
Thanks.
Take care.